യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദികേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാനതോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ ക്രമാത് വിവരണസ്യ ച. So we are continuing the discussion on dharana. So as we mentioned earlier, dharana is mind's fixation on a particular point in space. So this dharana is one of the antarangas, internal disciplines. Internal limbs is called samyama, dharana, dhyana, samadhi, 6th, 7th and 8th of ashtanga yoga. The earlier one is called bahiranga, yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara. The first 5 disciplines together can be called bahiranga, external. The other one is internal, so it's antaranga, internal. Now, there are a few important things that I want to mention about dharana. The first point is, dharana is sometimes, or could be translated as concentration. That's normally done. Now, and dhyanam is meditation. This is our normal translation. There is a little difficulty in this translation. Dhyanam actually is not what the word meditation implies in Christian mystical tradition. Because in Christian mystical tradition, meditation traditionally in the monastic circles meant reflection, reflecting on the meaning and essence of certain selected passages with great concentration. That is what it actually meant in the early days. And instead of meditation, the word contemplation was more frequently used to mean what dhyanam implies in yoga. Now, one may ask this question, what is the difference between dharana and dhyanam? Well, from a very practical point of view, dharana means fixing the mind on some object. But it is not a continuous fixing of mind on an object. There are gaps in between. What it means, a gap, I would say. So in the next sutra, I would just take the other sutra to drive home the idea, because both are interrelated. Tatra pratyekatanata dhyanam. This means pratyekatanata. Now, pratyaya is the word used here. Pratyaya actually means knowledge, cognition. Pratiyante iti pratyaya jnanam. It is knowledge. And pratyaya is a vritti. So one should not get mixed up these two words to be understood. Dharana and dhyanam. Dhyanam means pratyayasya ekatanata, means continuous flow of the same cognition at the same point without any break. Now, cognition of pratyaya involves vritti. In dharana, what is happening is all the vrittis, there are many vrittis, all the vrittis are centered around one single idea or an object. Say, for example, that's why I said in a meditation, actually it is a kind of dharana, not really dhyanam. In fact, all the meditative practices that we do, that are recommended, that are prescribed and discussed in many different traditions and circles, all these different forms of meditation are not different forms of dhyanam, they are only different forms of dharana. Because while doing this reflection, there are various vrittis coming. But all the vrittis, there will be slight differences, changes in the vrittis. They are centered around one particular idea. But there is not; it is not continuous. It is not like the flow of a stream of oil from one vessel to another vessel. There are breaks. But all the vrittis are trying to fix. We are trying to fix all the vrittis on one particular object. Each vritti could be different from each other vritti, but they are similar. And that particular process is called, in the Patanjali system or Vedanta system, is called mananam. Mananam means, Shravana means we listen to a great idea, we read a great idea, then we deeply reflect on the meaning and essence of that idea. There, vrittis are the, means worlds, waves within the system. All these vrittis are trying to get around one idea. That's why we call it reflection, reflecting on the meaning of the Sermon on the Mount or even prayer or any of the statement of the Upanishads or anything. Deep understanding. We are fixing the mind on the essence of that particular thing. So we are able to enter deeper into the deeper and deeper implications in the inner significance of a great teaching. And the more we do so, the more it becomes a part of our system, the more we are able to remember later. This is called reflection, is called dharana. So most of the meditative practices that we do, really not, they're not different forms of dhyanam, because the word dhyanam is translated in most dictionaries as meditation. So the so-called meditative practices are not really dhyanam, they are only different forms of dharana. Because vrittis are there. Each vritti could be different from each other vritti. So, pratyaya or cognition or knowledge is also a vritti, a mental modification. So, they emerge one after another. But they are all focusing on one particular statement. But still they are different. That when we are trying to focus all the vritti, the whole attention on one idea, naturally all the vrittis, which are different, not continuous flow, but different one after another, similarity is there, but also different, they are centered around one great idea. So it is called reflection. I am reflecting on the meaning of this word. I am reflecting on some psalms, prayers, Greek statement, Vedanta statement. Dhyanam is different. In dhyanam, there is only one vritti, one pratyaya. Actually, there is no vritti in dhyanam. When all the differences in pratyayas, cognition, vanish, it's just one single. So it is a continuous flow that is called pratyaya ekatanata. Is dhyanam. And this is not the result of any effort. If we may reflect with great effort, trying to focus our mind on one particular word, mantra, for a statement or prayer and meditate with great effort. And then we get the deeper implications of those things. That's now those who have done this a lot of times and practiced this dharana for a long time, they can retain whatever they read in their mind, because the moment they read a word, the whole mind stuff, all the vrittis, get completely focused on that particular idea. So it is retained. But it means it is a very powerful pratyaya. But they are different. They come one after another. But then they have similarity. In dhyanam, there is no break. There is no plurality of vrittis. The pratyaya is only one. The knowledge is only one. One becomes identified with this. That's why in the mantra shastra, in the science of repeating holy names or reading great spiritual ideas, spiritual statements, there is a gradual evolution from gross to subtle. It is para pasyanti madhyama vaikari. A word has got four dimensions. If you loudly shout, it is the grossest and the most external. And in a way, it is the lowest type of meditation or prayer. There are some prayer groups, you know, very violent, very, very vocal, loud shouting. In a way, it is good. Instead of shouting something else, it is good to shout prayers, true. But then, it is not bad. It's certainly good, because if they don't shout so loudly, their mind, their attention will be scattered into so many different distractions. They will get dissipated. So there will be a lot of distractions. So we have to chant a mantra or a prayer very loudly. This is the beginning of chanting mantras. It's called vaikari, means it's vocal. Loud prayers, loudly uttering the mantras or prayers or psalms. Then there is a higher and more subtle form of chanting the same mantras. It is called madhyama. Madhyama means it is more subtle, where the sound may not be very so loudly audible, but it may be lips may be moving. There will be some little sound a bit. So the third stage is pasyanti, where one may not be, your lips won't move, you pray, you are in a state of prayerfulness, but there is no external symptom. Your mind is always immersed in that prayerfulness. In such persons won't hear, even there is a disturbance in the room nearby, they won't hear, because they are so focused, so they won't hear anything. So this is called pasyanti. Para is mean the highest, where you become one with the essence of the mantra or the sacred symbol or the psalm or prayer that you chant, where the subject object differentiation vanishes. We become one with the essence of what we are trying, what prayer we are going to make. So that's why Sri Ramakrishna says, you know, those who do loud kirtans, when they reach the highest level of being immersed in the essence of their prayer, they become silent. Because silence is the language of the highest experience. That's why, you know, there is a statement Antaya Bhuvadinam Anantaya Mukham. Durgveda says the language of the infinity silence. So when we reach a very high level of that identification with the object we are meditating upon or chanting, then we become silent. So through this dhyanam, we reach that state. But dharana, different forms of dharanas, are only different attempts to slowly reach this level of dhyanam. So that's as an introduction, I wanted to make this difference. So in dhyanam, there is only pratyekatanada, means the same continuous flow of the same cognition, same pratyaya, same identity, in one great ideal, you meditate. That's highest, what we call contemplation, may be a better word to use, because the word, English word meditation, as understood in practical terms in the 19th century and early 20th century Christian mystical circles, really meant reflection, reflecting on the meaning of a great statement with serious thinking. At a higher level, it becomes contemplation, where you become silent. So this is only an introduction. Now we'll come back to the subject of dharana. So as I mentioned, dharana is mind's fixation on a particular point in space. So this fixing of mind could be either on knowledge or some high ideal. It may be a great spiritual ideal, a great spiritual truth, or it could be on an ideal of a rather external type. Means you try to fix your mind on the lotus of the heart. So that's why, you know, Vyasa says Hridaya Pundarika, means the lotus of the heart. Because the heart, as I said earlier, the heart is the essence of our personality. When we identify ourselves, we identify with what we have in the heart. And also on the sound, of course, in the yoga system, in the dharana system, the sound like Om. Now, Om, the word Om uttered in the proper way, has got a great significance. It is the essence of existence. A, Uma, these three letters included in Om, they also they symbolize the three levels of our consciousness or our awareness, our experience: the waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state. So whatever we experience, the whole creation, the whole existence, we experience in these three states. So the word Om, if a person meditates, contemplates on the word Om as the essence of his personality, or your spiritual symbol, the idea of God, the concept of God, the aspect of God whom you meditate, whom you have accepted in your life, as being seated in the heart. This is also one kind of dharana. So, this dharana involves some effort. So there is a vritti involved. It is called dharana. Now today we are going to take the new topic, the tatra vritti ekatanada dhyanam. So I already mentioned here. So now we will discuss the subject, dhyanam. I already mentioned that in dharana, each vritti is followed by a different vritti, but there is similarity. That's why we are able to concentrate, meditate, reflect upon. In dhyanam, each vritti is followed by the same vritti, so there is no difference in vrittis. Now, how do we achieve perfection in meditation? Because we have to use a word that has become common, current. Dhyanam. Now, how do we reach perfection? For that, we have to understand the process of meditation. As I said, it is a continuous flow of the same cognition. Now, every act of cognition has got three aspects. One is the subject, the grihita, we call it grihitra, the one who cognizes, the cognizer, and what you cognize, what you try to understand, the object, grahya it is called, the object, subject, object. And then grahana means the process of cognizing the knowledge, the relationship between subject and object. So in any kind of cognition, we have got these three supports called alambana, a subject, an object, and a relationship between a subject and object. And as a result of this relationship, cognition emerges. This is in yoga terminology. The same idea is put in Vedanta, in Advaita Vedanta. It is called jnata, jnaya, and jnanam. Jnata means jnatra, the one who perceives, who knows, the knower. Jnaya means the object that is known, and jnanam means the process of knowing. The highest experience in Vedanta, in Advaita, is when you feel, when you experience that what you are seeking is the object, the jnaya, the object that you are trying to know, is non-different and non-distinct from yourself. That means the knower and the known are the same. Wherever there is a distinction between the knower and known, there are all these three processes. Knowledge, knower and known, subject, object, and the relationship between these two. There, dualism. When you transcend dualism, when you reach Advaitic Vedanta, then there is these three bodies, these three dimensions, the knower, known, and knowledge merge into one. Remember, Advaita is not fully accepted, not acceptable to yoga, Sankhya philosophers. I mentioned this in the earlier classes. Yoga is a great help for us to reach a very high level of mental fitness and mental purity, training to understand the essence of Advaita. So that's the whole importance of yoga. So that way yoga has got a great importance. So as I mentioned, any experience in which one of these two is missing cannot be called a pratyaya or cognition. But in samadhi, what happens? The subject and object get fused. And the resulting experience is called samadhi prajna in yoga terminology. So in samadhi state, the cognizer, the perceiver, the knower, and the known merge into one, get fused. So this is the essence of dhyanam. Now Vyasa says, dhyana is sadrisha pravaha pratyayantarena aparamashtaka. Means the flow of the same stream of cognition. The same cognition flows undisturbed. That is called dhyanam. At that stage, one transcends the distinction between the subject, the object, and the relationship between the two, the process of knowing. One becomes one. That's the highest samadhi state. Now, I think we must understand this this background of this yoga system. When we go beyond this, we must get an idea of the yoga philosophy, because without that, we won't be able to, without recapitulating that aspect. So as I mentioned, yoga philosophy is one of the six systems of theistic philosophy, one of the six theistic systems of philosophy. Sankhya and yoga are interrelated. Sankhya and yoga, Purva Mimamsa, Uttara Mimamsa, Nyaya and Vaisheshika. We are concerned with Sankhya and yoga. Sankhya is important because Sankhya is the philosophical aspect of yoga. Yoga is the practical aspect. Yoga borrows its philosophical structure from Sankhya system. So, in a way, Sankhya gives you the cosmology and the metaphysics of yoga. So, in Sankhya system, there are two fundamental categories. One is Prakriti and Purusha. What we are discussing here now should be understood in the context of this fundamental philosophical doctrine. Two fundamental absolute categories. So that means Sankhya system or yoga system is essentially a dualistic system of philosophy. It is not non-dualistic, dualistic. There are two fundamental absolute categories, of which the conscious principle is called Purusha, that is the intellect principle. And this Purusha is a witness. The Purusha is not involved in the creation. That's why if you go to the conclusions of yoga system or Sankhya system, you will be bewildered, because there is an element of logical fallacy in the Sankhya conclusions. That's the view of Vedantins. But the Sankhya, the details of Sankhya cosmology are acceptable in Vedanta, but the conclusions of Sankhya and yoga are not acceptable. But yoga has got a great importance, because to understand how our mind functions, how our indriyas, our senses function, how thoughts get accumulated in the mind, how a personality evolves, and why do we behave the way we are behaving now? Why do we act the way we are acting? Why do we speak the way we are speaking? These areas are very systematically and very psychologically analyzed in the yoga system. All these details are fully accepted in Vedanta because they are highly logical and highly psychological. So that's the relationship between yoga and Vedanta. So the conclusions of yoga can be understood only with the help of Vedanta. So as I said, there are two fundamental categories. Purusha is a supreme category. It is conscious, it is witness, it doesn't get itself involved in any kind of action or activity. The other category is Prakriti. We are concerned with that. So Prakriti itself means, literally it means, it is the uncaused cause. It's not. It doesn't come from anything, but it becomes the cause of everything. The whole universe, the whole cosmos, consists of 23 evolutes of Prakriti. The Prakriti, in some books you will understand, you may get this word. Prathanam is another word used in this. Because it is the first cause, but it is an uncaused cause. So out of this Prakriti, all these 23 principles evolved. First, Mahat, the great cosmic intelligence. And then the Ahankara, This is the egoity. The ahankara has got three dimensions, sattvika, rajasika, and tamasika. From sattvika, ahankara, the mind and the senses evolved. From tamasika, ahankara, the five subtle elements, and from them the five gross elements. Like that this world is created. Now what's the purpose of our practicing yoga, ashtanga yoga, kriya yoga, meditation, all that? That should be understood before we proceed further. The purpose is we should know our true nature. What's our true nature? Our true nature is that we are something other than this evolute. Right now, when we think that we are this body, nothing more, this mind, this intellect, all this part of the creation, then we are just one of the several evolutes that constitutes this creation. And this cosmos, consisting of these evolutes, is subject to change. We are ourselves under the delusion that we are part of this matter. Prakriti is a matter, and matter is a permanent absolute reality in Sankhya system. That is an interesting thing. That's why it's called, it's a dualistic system. And it does not fully accept the idea of a creator God. Of course, there are two fundamental streams in the Sankhya metaphysical system. One is the old Sankhya system, is Kapila's, which we know the conclusions of Kapila system because the Bhagavata Purana gives a long exposition, but his sutra literature are not available. We have not got original manuscript. And Kapila's Sankhya system is non-dualistic, and it is not agnostic or atheistic. Later on, after several centuries, maybe in the 4th century AD or so, a great Sankhya philosopher, Ishvara Krishna, he wrote his sutras, Ishvara Krishna Sankhya sutras, which are now available as a textbook. And his system, as we get today, is dualistic and somewhat atheistic. Though there have been many Sankhya philosophers who tried to project a God, but not with a great status. I mean, the God whom some of the Sankhya philosophers tried to project doesn't have the same status as the monotheistic Godhead in popular Hinduism or any of the Abrahamic religious traditions. So that much. Now, in what way is yoga related to this? Through yogic practice, we are trying to travel backward. Right now, we think we are this body, this mind. Body as a matter is the result of pancha tanmatras, is the result of five gross elements, which are the evolutes of five subtle elements. Subtle elements is tanmatra. Gross elements means these, it's called in Vedanta, it's called Vayu, Agni, Rapa, etc. Akashat Vayu, Akasha, Vayu, Agni, Teja, of course there's Agni, then Jala and Prithvi. Prithvi means matter, Jala means the water principle, Agni means fire principle, Akasha is space, and Vayu is air principle. So five elements, gross elements, which are evolutes of five subtle elements. And then our mind also is one of the evolutes of Prakriti. So mind is a matter, not only for modern scientists, but also for Sankhya philosophers. So for Vedantins, mind is nothing but a name of a vritti, a function, a level of function of the vrittis, which are made possible because the presence of Atman, one eternal, absolute, conscious reality behind. So through all this practice, we travel our journey backward. We go back to our source. What's our source? Prakriti is not our source. Our true nature is Purusha, the conscious principle. But because of the close proximity of Purusha and Prakriti, our true nature, that we are Purusha, the conscious principle, we have forgotten. And through the yoga, we get back to our true stature, our true awareness we are trying to regain. That's the purpose of all this yoga system. So, in other words, there is the Purusha is an involved state in us. When we practice yoga, we try to re-manifest this true identity of our nature, the consciousness within us. Just as there's a big tree in a seed. Why? Because the seed sprouts, becomes a plant, and becomes a huge tree. If the huge tree was not present in the seed, in involved state, the seed would not have grown into the big tree. So the Sankhya philosophers say that this Prakriti really goes through real transformation and becomes all this created universe. If it is real transformation, how can we get back to it? See, you get oil from seeds. It's a real transformation. Why? Because the oil cannot go back to its seed form. If you make a golden ornament from gold, that golden ornament, the necklace or whatever it is, can go back to its gold. You melt it, it goes back to gold, of course. You make pots and pans from clay, you break it, it goes back to clay. But Sankhya philosophers say it's not like that. It's not like the transfiguration. It's called transfiguration, as you find in the example of necklaces and ornaments coming out of gold, or the cloth coming out of threads. No. They say it's like oil that comes out of seed. Now, Vedantin steps in here. You are totally wrong, the Vedantin. Say the Sankhyas. That's what Shankaracharya did all his works. He told the Sankhyas, your analysis of human mind is wonderful. Your analysis of the human intelligence is absolutely wonderful. The way indriyas function, the way cognition takes place, these are all marvelous theories from the Sankhyas. But where you go wrong is, if it is real transformation, then we cannot really go back to our true nature. So Vedantin say, we do not really become anything. We appear to have become this. It is not real transformation, it is only an apparent transformation. So it is only transfiguration. It's called Vivarta. Vivarta means not real transformation, apparently. It's just like you have got a golden chain. Gold has not become the chain. Then what happened? The gold, along with a peculiar foam, the round foam, is called golden chain. You remove that foam, the shape, then you don't call it golden chain, it's called gold. So the gold only appears to become transformed, not real transformation, only apparent transformation into golden ornament. Because this golden ring was, a golden necklace was in an involved state, was it pre-exists in gold. Otherwise, just like tree pre-exist in the seed. That's why the tree comes out of the seed. Or the pots and pans made of clay pre-exist in clay. An expert pot maker makes use of his machine and he turns out pots and pans from clay. Now Vedantin steps in and say, as I said earlier, the Sankhya and Yoga philosophers are absolutely wonderful so far as the analysis of human mind, the vrittis, vasana, samskara, all the marvelous discoveries, detailed analytical studies and conclusions of the Sankhya Yoga philosophers. They are as scientific and they are being accepted more and more because in modern times we understand how relevant they are. If we can understand why we are behaving the way, if we can understand why I am talking like this, why I react like this, why am I getting angry, why am I getting anxious, though there is no reason for it, then we can somehow get out of this problem. So this Sankhya yoga system, of course, it comes from Sankhya, is very relevant in modern times. So that connecting link should be maintained. That's why I just brought back this philosophical background of the yoga philosophy. Now we're coming to the subject. So we already discussed this subject, you know. The tatra pratyaya ekatanata dhyanam. One important point is ekatanata. Ekatanata means when the mind continuously flows towards one object, naturally, spontaneously, continuously, without any break. That is called dhyanam. So why this ekatanata is used? So you have to keep in mind, now the mind is constantly changing. What do we mean by this statement, mind is always in a flux, constantly changing? It only means one vritti can remain only for a split second. That's only the thing. So when we say, when we make the statement, you know, we cannot predict how our mind is going to function next moment, what thoughts are going to emerge in my mind next moment, I can decide in which direction I can walk, I shall walk. The gross level, the subtle level, we can never be sure what thought is going to emerge in my mind next moment. The reason is the vritti that is there in my mind right now will remain there only for a split second. That vritti will disappear and another vritti will emerge in the mind. In fact, that's one of the reasons why when we read a book or when you see, we are not able to recollect. Memory is closely related to the ability of a person to keep vrittis centered around one single subject. That is the real, that's also a kind of genius. What we understand by genius, you know. Genius is a person who can, in a way, who can exclude all unnecessary, unrelated vrittis and vasanas and concentrate himself completely on one particular subject. It is one kind of dharana, not dhyanam, but it's one kind of dharana. In the case of a great scientist who may be a genius, his mind also is changing. In the sense, the same vritti doesn't remain for a long time. But all the vrittis get connected. So there is an element of similarity in the emerging vrittis, innumerable vrittis in his mind. So that enables him to go deeper into subjects and unravel some of the intricacies of subjects. Say an area of knowledge or a subject or a book which others may not be able to do, because in the case of other people, they may not be able to make their vrittis similar. Each vrittis become totally dissimilar from each other, totally different. If there is a difference in vrittis, as we already know, people who cannot concentrate for a long time, retain their attention for a long time, is because of the splitting of vrittis, or one vritti being followed by an entirely different and opposite vritti. So, okay, now we will have interaction. After that, there is any subject to be discussed.
So at one point, Swami, you mentioned going back, which is comes in Plato's philosophy, it comes in other philosophies. Can you enlarge on that a little bit?
Yeah. You know, there are many modern thinkers who, of course, beyond Plato, I mean, the 7th century Thales, great. Thales of Miletus, he was a great thinker. So many, many thinkers and specialists in comparative philosophy tried to see connections and similarities between even pre-Socrates Greek philosophers and the Sankhya system. Yeah, going back here means trying to get back to our true nature. So one of the synonyms of prakriti is avyakta, or it's called, in this means unmanifested. Unmanifest means it has not become this visible pluralistic world of different names and forms and changing one after another. Do we have a dimension to a personality which is different from this matter? Because if we are just an evolute of prakriti, then we are only part of the material world. In fact, mind also is matter according to Sankhya system, yoga system. So mind also evolves from the sattvika dimension of ahankara, means egoity, which again comes from mahat buddhi, and that also is an evolute of prakriti. So in a way, it is also an evolute. Mind also is an evolute. Intellect also is an evolute. So do we have something which is not an evolute? So once we realize that we are not part of this cosmic, the cosmos which consists of these evolutes, then we get back to our true nature. What's our true nature? Our true nature is that we are Purusha. When Prakriti comes in close proximity with Purusha, then what happens? The Purusha itself begins to be deluded, and as a result of this, the whole evolution takes place. From a spiritual perspective, and there we have to take the help of Vedanta. The Sankhya system is as a fallacy in its conclusion, as I mentioned earlier. Why this creation? So Sankhya philosophers will tell you, if you read Sankhya Karya, Isha Krishna Sankhya Karya, you say, Purusha can see, but is inactive. Prakriti is very active, but cannot see. Prakriti is unconscious, Purusha is conscious thing. So they join together. So what happens, you know, Prakriti holds Purusha in its shoulders. So Purusha is sitting in Prakriti's shoulders. So Prakriti can walk, is very healthy. Purusha can direct. Prakriti is jada, it's unconscious. But Purusha can direct this way to go. It has eyes. So the whole creation is explained in the light of this Andha Pangu Nyaya. Andha means blind. Prakriti is blind, and Purusha is lame, in the sense he cannot walk. It is only a symbolic presentation in the Sankhya system. So the point is, once we get back to our true nature, it's like opening our eyes one day, suddenly wake up, oh, I'm really not just this physical body. I've got another aspect in it. I'm worried about every small, petty things taking around me. I've lost money. So I think I'm just a miserable human being who could get anxious, who get worried, who shed tears for days and days because a few pieces of papers are stolen from me. Or all these problems that we encounter in this world are rooted in one fundamental basic ignorance. That is, we think we are only this body and mind. We have got another dimension. At this dimension is that we are not part of this prakriti. We are not an evolute of prakriti. We are not an evolute of the matter. We are not a piece of matter. We have got another dimension. As when we get back to our true nature, we realize we are not part of this material world. In Vedanta, you realize the presence of Atman, the all-pervading immanent reality within you, which is your true I in Vedanta. In the Sankhya system, we understand we are not part of this cosmic universe which consists of so many evolutes. We are the real Purusha, which is conscious reality. That's why Sankhya system, yoga system should be studied along with Vedanta. So Vedanta comes and fills up the vacuum left by the Sankhya yoga philosophical system. Vedanta says getting back to our true nature means realizing the truth that we are something other than this physical body, which comes and goes, and our mind will be happy and unhappy. We have something higher than this. This self-discovery of true nature is what is meant by involution or going backward. Actually, it's not going backward, we are going forward. But from the present state of mind, we are trying to, am I this physical body? It made of, tanmatras, subtle elements. In fact, in actual life, what is happening, you can see this in real life. People who are at the physical level, the slightest pain, the slightest disease, the slightest inconvenience, discomfiture, can make them totally upset, to a devastating effect, impact on their life. But if such a person, an unhealthy person who is suffering from some sickness, is writing an important book on philosophy, or is a great scientist, or a great medical practitioner, then you find his slight physical illness will not upset him so much. He can enjoy life in the laboratory, in the library, in the teaching room, because his dimension, the dimension of his personality, is slightly higher than the physical. Now, if you can transcend the physical when you reach the mental or intellectual, why can't you transcend the intellectual or mental by reaching the higher level, the spiritual level, the Atman level? That's what Vedanta says. Once you reach that stage, then even mental fluctuations, happiness or unhappiness, will not upset you. This is what we are. So in a way, we are ascending, but in Sankhya's system, we can say going back to the Purusha state means involving going, I mean the mighty tree going backward to seed form. The seed is not inferior to the tree. The seed is actually superior, because the seed in a small form condenses the potency of becoming a mighty tree. It's called Satkaryavada in Veda, in the Indian philosophical tradition, means the idea that effect pre-exists in cause. The effect is not coming from outside. The effect is nothing but something that pre-exists in cause. So this Satkaryavada, or the doctrine that the essence pre-exists in cause, has got two main schools, which are different from the other. One school is called Parinamavada, means the school who believes in real, actual transformation, like the seeds becoming oil. The other school, which believes the transformation that is only apparent, it's called transfiguration, not real transformation, like the gold appearing to be the necklace. Why it appears to be? Why do you call it an apparent transformation? It is not real transformation, because if it is real transformation, then the gold necklace cannot go back to its golden form. So you melt it, goes back to gold. So it's only apparent. So Vedantins believe, Advaita Vedanta, non-dualistic school, believes that Brahman is the absolute reality. That's our true nature, Atman. Once we understand this, then if we can evolve and ascend slowly, then we reach our spiritual dimension, Atman dimension, going beyond the body, beyond the mind, reaching the highest level of Atman. That's the idea behind. So in a way, Plato's system mostly linked to the Sankhya influence in the Greek philosophy. So you've had Anaxagoras, Pythagoras, Pythagoras was almost a contemporary of Buddha. So there is a view that the Sankhya system highly influenced Greek philosophy, and to that extent Greek philosophy became so vigorous, so unafraid of, fearless of people asking questions, which of course that tradition came to an end with the emergence of St. Paul in the 1st century and St. Augustine in the 5th century. So, thank you. So, before conclusion, there is an announcement for you. We will not have class the next two Fridays because of Shanti Ashrama and other programs. So the next class will be on Friday, May the 13th at 7:30 p.m. So the next class will be on Friday, May 13th, same place. So, you know, Shanti Ashrama is the beginning of our Vedanta movement in California. 1900, one of the disciples of Sri Ramakrishna Swami, Tiriyanandaji, went and started a meditation class there. He started an ashrama. So we are holding a one-day retreat on April the 30th, Saturday morning from 10 to 5 o'clock. So please remember, there will be no class till May the 13th. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om. That's it. Sri Ramakrishna Prasthana.